Founding Father John Adams once said, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." But today, traditional morality and virtue are mocked by many of our leading elites. Author Dr. Bill Donahue, the president of the Catholic League, has written a new book entitled The War on Virtue, How the Ruling Class is Killing the American Dream. I'm Jerry Newcomb. This is Vocal Point, and we welcome Dr. William Donahue back to the program. Bill, it's great to have you back on. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Jerry. Thank you.
Sure. All right, here's a quote about the book, your new book. Quote, "The ruling class is systematically undermining the virtues that have built Western civilization and producing a moral holocaust that the traditional family cannot withstand." I'll stop right there and have you comment on that. Why did you write this book, and what is it all about?
Well, I wrote this book largely because I've long had an interest in upward mobility, and for that matter, those who don't seem to strive. Everybody wants the American dream. You never met anybody who didn't want to have it. And it's not completely economic and educational achievement, though it is largely that. And I'm looking at the way our society has been operating, particularly over the last 10 years in particular. And it's striking to me that when I studied what makes for success in individuals and in demographic groups, I came to the conclusion that's what I call the vital virtues. Now, there are many virtues that are important, but in terms of economic and educational achievement, if you don't accept a sense of personal responsibility for your actions, if you don't practice self-discipline, and if you don't learn to persevere and practice the virtue of perseverance, you're not going to succeed in life in any endeavor, whether you're an athlete, whether you're a doctor, whether you're a business person, whatever you might be. You could be a firefighter. You've got to be able to possess these virtues. And what strikes me in our society today is how the ruling class, the elites, who are making the decision makers in the primary institutions of our society, they are not only not encouraging them and nurturing them, they're going out of their way to destroy them. And that, to me, is one of the great horror stories of our time.
Well, here's a quote from your book. "So-called progressivism has proven to be one of the most regressive forces in the country." You know, that's an interesting point, because I think that term progressive it's not fair. Because, you know, they don't stand for progress. They stand for regress, and, you know, they don't stand for people improving themselves.
No, you're right, Jerry. And they always, of course, get the right appellation for themselves to put a favorable spin on things. But one of the points of the book, it's a heavy subtext of the book, is that the reason why African Americans haven't done as well as I regard the four stellar groups in our society, Asians, Jews, Mormons, and Nigerians. Those are the four successful stories. I mean, lots of people have succeeded, but those group par excellence. Down toward the bottom really would be African Americans. Now, there is a history of slavery and discrimination, which nobody can deny, which plays a large role. But if you think that's the answer to why blacks aren't doing well today, then somebody needs to explain to me, why is it that two of the four groups I just mentioned, Asians and Nigerians, are people of color? No, it's not color of skin that is holding back blacks today. If anything, it's a bounce. If you have certain attributes, you get it's a plus today. No, what's holding back black family today, the blacks today, is largely because of the family structure, which was undermined by the left, by the ruling elite in the 1960s, all the way through slavery, right up through racism, discrimination, the worst parts of it. The black family, in as recently as the 1950s, in the mid-20th century, was much, much, much better off in the heyday of race and discrimination than it was subsequently. And that's because of welfare dependency type projects that were pushed on them. And I do make a point in the book of introducing to the reader somebody who most people never heard of. His name is George Fitzhugh. Back in 1850s, America's first sociologist, he was on the side of blacks. He was a left-wing progressive, and he also was in favor of slavery. So people say, wait, how can a guy be in favor of helping blacks and he's defending slavery? Because he said, and the words are, it's in the book, I mean, much stronger than what I'm going to give you. He said they're basically a stupid people. Nobody can help them. And they are the freest people in the world because the white man is taking care of them because they can't compete. If you didn't have slavery, you'd have a market economy, a capitalist economy, and then you have to compete head-to-head with the white man. They can't do that. They're indolent, stupid people. So now that thinking, people might say, well, why did you bring up the 1850s? Let's fast forward to the late 19th, early 20th century. The progressive era, Richard Ely, one of the leaders, said essentially the same thing as Fitzhugh. Now let's fast forward to 1988. Charles Murray, the great social scientist, says we are living in a state of the coming of the custodial democracy, where white elites will be the custodians taking care of black people the way we take care of Indians on the reservation, except the reservation will be in the urban area. They will be wards of the state. My point very quickly is this. The white left progressive ruling class, and they are the ruling class today. Wall Street is all on the left. They don't look at black people as equals. They have a patronizing, condescending attitude that if we don't take care of them, they don't come out and say exactly what Fitzhugh did or Ely, but it's pretty much the same mentality. They can't cut it on their own like the Jews and the Nigerians and the Mormons and everybody else. And so we have to do things for them, equity, education. We're going to hold back the Asians and we're going to push forward the blacks. It's all born of liberal racism because you're not treating people as equals.
Wow, that's so interesting. You know, by the way, that reminds me when people say, well, you can't have voter identification laws because that's discriminatory. That's anti-black. And then I've heard, you know, even some black critics of that thinking say, oh, so in other words, we can't go out and get our own driver's licenses? What's wrong with you people?
Look, I saw that when I was working in Spanish Harlem back in the 1970s. I saw the liberal teachers come in, paid for by the government, to do remedial class work with some of the kids who were struggling in certain subjects. They did not hold them to the same standards that I held my kids to, because I didn't treat the black and Puerto Rican kids any different than I would have treated white kids. They did. And they'd say, why are you so hard on these kids and insisting on the homework to be this way and that way? I said, because I'm not a racist. Because when you go into the white areas and the suburban areas, you have higher expectations. Well, you have lower expectations. They said, well, build the neighborhoods bad. I said, don't you think I know that? You come in here once a week. I'm here 5 days a week. And in fact, I'm here 6 days a week because I work with the kids and play basketball with them on weekends. That's back when I was in my 20s. And I said, so I know what the conditions are, which is why I work at a Catholic school where I can insist on discipline and the three R's of reading, writing, and arithmetic and make them work. I said, but if you keep lowering the bar, you're just basically setting up a recipe for failure. I keep the bar high, and my job is to help them clear it. Your job, as you see it, is to keep dumbing down the standards, and then you're surprised that nobody can read or write or do arithmetic.
Wow, that's so true. Okay, you mentioned welfare a few moments ago and its devastation on, you know, let's say the black community or much of it. Where does fatherlessness fit in that equation? It's my understanding that in effect, what the welfare state did was it rewarded fatherlessness as opposed to, you know, it strengthened the inner city family.
Well, that's right. And this is back in the 1960s, New York. It started here and then it spread elsewhere. The idea was that if the father wasn't at home, the woman and her children would get more money in the form of welfare, and they gave an invitation of the man to leave. And we didn't have that in the 1950s. In the 1950s, the economy wasn't as robust as it was in the 1960s. Isn't it strange when we had low unemployment? The unemployment rate was practically zero, and it was very low for blacks, too. We're talking 3.5% and 4% in both cases, which is practically zero, because there's always that many people just looking for a job anyhow in the workforce. And why is it when the economy is doing well that the welfare state exploded? It doesn't make any economic sense. If you're talking about the 1930s, of course you're going to have welfare-type roles. Why? Because you had a depression. Why, when the economy is good, would the welfare roads explode? Because it was politically driven by a couple of professors, in particular, out of Columbia, Francis Fox Pivot and Richard Cloward, a husband and wife couple. They advised Mayor Lindsay, John Lindsay in New York, that we should find every person who's remotely eligible and put them on the dole, even if they're able-bodied, because they thought that if New York, they actually said this, if New York goes bankrupt, then the federal government have to step in and create socialism. That was their goal. They used black people as a pawn for their own political ambitions. This is a very ugly story. Yes, of course, there were some people who had good intentions and they made a mistake. That happens in the real world, and I don't condemn those people because they had good motives. I am talking about people who knew exactly what they were doing, and they manipulated simple-minded people like John Lindsay, who not only made New York City go bankrupt, he's in his own personal life a wealthy man. He wound up bankrupt, made a lot of bad decisions, but these people knew what they were doing, and that's part of the point of the book, too, that when you have the Smithsonian Institute of African American History and Culture telling black people that to be a hard worker and self-reliant and to insist on objectivity and to believe in the scientific method and correct spelling in English, that's a form of whiteness. That's whiteness? I thought that was excellence. And so what are you teaching? To be indolent, to don't strive well in school. I mean, this is the kind of recipe that the Ku Klux Klan would revel. So here we have the Ku Klux Klan. Everybody knows they're racist. They come together with the white ruling class who have given up on black people. That's my point in the book. They've literally given up. And that, to me, is the ultimate form of racism.
And here's a quote from your book. If Americans become convinced that their country is fatally flawed, why will they bother to defend it? Boy, it's so true. We got to get people to appreciate the opportunities they have here in America. But I guess that, you know, some people view that statement as being racist.
Well, the army is down now by 25% in meeting its goal. Now, we're teaching kids to hate America, not in every school, but in too many of them. And they're starting in kindergarten and pre-K. They're going right through, of course, in graduate school. That's what they teach, that America is a racist country that rips people off. I wonder how they explain why is it that everybody keeps crashing our borders? Are these people delusional? Do they like to be whipped and tortured in America? What world do these people live in? Notice the ones who complain the most about America never leave, and the ones who all they hear is bad news, but just throw it right out the window, they keep crashing our borders wanting to come in. Now, if you teach people to hate their own country, the greatest country in the history of the world, then don't be surprised when some young people who've been indoctrinated, basically brainwashed by these left-wing college professors and starting in at the high school level and below, don't be surprised if they say, hey, listen, why would I want to defend this country? After all, we're not any better than anybody else. It's almost a form of national suicide, what's going on, when the elites, and I don't mean just the education, entertainment, the media people, we've always had them on the left. What I'm talking about is something new. It's only in the last 10 years. The corporations, the healthcare industry, the military, the FBI, I'm talking about the elites now. I'm not talking about the average person who works there. But the decision makers in those institutions have gone very far left. And they're teaching young people and their employees to hate America. I document this in the book, War on Virtue. It's all there. It's not a matter of opinion. I've read what the Salvation Army and Walmart are doing. They've joined the left-wing crusade, two traditional, normally conservative organizations. So that's why the alarm bells need to go off with Americans, and we have to demand accountability. What we need is more of a pushback, as we saw with Bud Light, okay? Because the American people said, enough is enough. Don't shove this transgender mania down my throat. It's one thing for ask me to tolerate people. It's another thing asking me to affirm their lifestyle, and I won't do that. So there are some good things happening where people need to push back.
Okay, we have 15 seconds for a closing thought, and your website is catholicleague.org, correct?
Yes, and you'll find all the information about the War on Virtue there by Sophia Institute Press and, of course, Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Okay, Dr. Bill Donahue, thanks so much for being with us. All the best.
Thank you so much, Jerry.